So I will present some few simple ideas on the directional detection of light dark matter. I will start with a review of the weakly interacting massive particle, and then say something about standard detection schemes for WIMPs, and then talk about directionality. So say something about directionality, something has been said in the previous talk, and then talk about carbon nanotubes, which have been proposed as a possible directional detection scheme. Then I will review what is meant by strongly interactive massive particle. This is an alternative paradigm to the WIMP, which has been proposed quite recently, and talk about electron recoils from graphene and carbon nanotubes due to strongly interactive massive particle. And then I will end with another directional detection experiment, which is the light shining through wall experiment for axion-like particles in a different regime, which is that of microwaves, and then some concluding remarks. So if what we call dark matter is the gravitational manifestation of an halo of unknown particles, then there is a quite large agreement that these particles should be the leftover particles of the early universe. And so the idea is that in the early universe, you would have equal number density of dark matter particles and dark matter antiparticles. And then these dark matter particles, to survive to the present, should be stable against decay. So they should carry some conservative multiplicative or additive quantum numbers. But then there is another issue. The dark matter particles and antiparticles can annihilate into standard particles. And so this mechanism could simply deplete the number of dark matter particles from the early universe to today. But as is well known, the expansion of the universe is kind of stopping this depletion at some point. And this is what is called the freeze-out process, or the thermalization of the relic particles. So at some point, the number densities are sufficiently low because of the expansion of the universe, and it is impossible to appreciably reduce the number of dark matter particles. So
what's the multiplicative quantum number?
The parity, for example, is a multiplicative quantum number. For example, if you have a decay of a phi meson into two pions, the phi has a negative parity, the two pions have a negative parity as well. And so you make the product of the parities of the final state, which has to match the initial state, and this decay cannot happen if it's not a p-wave decay. That's the usual definition of multiplicative quantum number.
Yes, but in that case, then it cannot... Can it be used to conserve a large density of particles? It just seems to me that it's always... Modulo 2, in a sense. No?
Yes, that's true. Indeed, when I will present the SIMP scenario, we will have something like that. Exactly. In the standard WIMP scenario, we will come to the weakly part of the world. Dark matter particles and antiparticles can just annihilate into standard model particles, and there should be some cross-section for this reaction to occur. And so one can define a rate, which is the product of the velocity of the dark matter in the early universe times the cross-section times the number density of dark matter particles and antiparticles. This has dimensions of seconds to the minus one. Now, the rate of decrease of dark matter particles in the number of leftover particles in a commoving volume is given by this quantity here multiplied by n times a to the cubic. What is a? A is the scale of expansion of the universe. And so since this is a number density, this scales as 1 over a cubic. And so if you want to look at a commoving box in the universe, you have to multiply by a to the cubic in such a way that you look always at the same commoving box, which is changing in time. Of course, There is not only annihilation of dark matter particles into standard model, there is also the inverse process. The thermal background of standard particles can create back the dark matter particles. And so at the equilibrium, you have a chemical equilibration of dark matter, anti-dark matter into standard model and back. At the equilibrium, the rate of decrease is basically the same as the creation rate by definition of equilibrium. And so at the equilibrium, this quantity, which is the number of leftover particles in a commoving volume, which is this quantity, is given by the n at equilibrium times a cubic and sigma d. And this allows you to write down the simple Boltzmann equation for this evolution, in which you look at the derivative with respect to time of the number of leftover particles in a commoving volume. If n is larger than the equilibrium, this will go in the direction of depletion. If n is smaller than n equilibrium, this will go in the opposite direction. It's very simple. But now, look at the situation. Look at the universe when it's extremely hot in such a way that the temperature is much larger than the mass of the wind. Then the equilibrium number density should scale as t cubic, which is the relativistic particle rate. And then t depends on the inverse power of the scale, as we can also see, but this is well known. And so what happens is that you have a kind of trivial solution of the Boltzmann equation, which is n of equilibrium. If you substitute n equilibrium in the Boltzmann equation, you have zero on both sides of the equation because n equilibrium goes like 1 over a cubic. So a cubic times n equilibrium is a constant, and then this solves the Boltzmann. In the opposite regime, when the temperature drops way below the mass of the dark matter particle, so in a late universe, the Boltzmann equation can be written without the creation term. So you can forget about this piece. And this is because when the temperature is very low, you pay a Gibbs price, say Boltzmann price, to produce the particles from the thermal background. And so you can ignore this term, the n equilibrium term, the production term, and remain only with this minus term over here. This equation can be solved easily. And you can connect the number of leftover particles in a commoving volume at a late time t with the number of leftover particles in a commoving volume at an early time t1. And this solution, interestingly enough, has a denominator which in principle could be infinity. Like if this integral here, which goes from the early time t1, where the universe had a very small scale factor, to the late time t, which the universe has a very large scale factor, if this integral diverges, then the number of leftover particles would be zero. And so the WIMP mechanism is based on the fact that this integral does not diverge. This is a kind of very intuitive solution of the Boltzmann equation, which gives you an idea of what the WIMP mechanism is. Of course, the problem can be recasted, reformulated in a more refined way. You can take the Boltzmann equation, and instead of considering its evolution in time, you can consider its evolution in temperature. And in order to do that, you can use a general principle of cosmology that the expansion of the universe is adiabatic in all respects. That means that the entropy, the commoving entropy is constant. So this is the entropy density times a cubic, it's a constant now. And if you use this equation, which is a kind of important postulate of cosmology, with the Friedmann equation without the curvature term, you find a relation between time and temperature in the thermal history of the universe. And this is straightforwardly giving you dt as a function of the temperature. This x is a dimensionless quantity, which is temperature divided. Now you introduce the mass of the leftover particle in the game, in such a way to have all dimensionless quantity. So the equation that usually is solved when one thinks to WIMPs is a Riccati equation, which is made up only of dimensionless term. This is the number density divided by KB t cubic, so it's dimensionless, this is dimensionless. And in this B term, you have the cross section for the annihilation of WIMPs, which is some of dark matter particles, and the mass of dark matter particles. Now I can justify the term WIMP, weakly interacting. The justification of the term weakly interacting is just here. So what is this cross section? Now the general assumption, which is a kind of completely free assumption, is that this cross section is controlled by the Fermi constant. So WIMP, so dark matter particles annihilate into standard model particles with a coupling, which is the Fermi coupling. And so just on dimensional reasons, this thermal average should be G Fermi squared times the mass, now we can say the WIMP of the weakly interacting massive particle, times some fudge factor, which is just counting the number of channels that you have in the reaction, or is counting, or is kind of including a rescale from the Fermi constant to some other constant, depending on the model you want to use. Originally, the idea of Weinberg et al. Was to imagine that this weakly interactive massive particle do interact at the Fermi scale. So one can compute the density of WIMP in the present universe, and that can be done solving the Riccati equation and looking for a solution of the Riccati equation at very small temperature. Indeed, if you remember, there is this x here in the Riccati equation, which is temperature divided by the mass of the WIMP. If the temperature is much smaller than the mass of the WIMP, x is essentially zero. And if you require that the energy density of the WIMP is basically making the entire density of matter in the universe, so you require that the WIMP are the most important component, you find a formula for the WIMP mass. What is interesting about this formula is that if you decide that the WIMP interaction into standard particles is at the Fermi constant, then this formula is providing you with a number for the expected mass of the WIMP. This is, of course, an hypothesis. This number comes from the Rayleigh abundance, from the fact that the WIMP must make most of the mass. This number is about 10 GeV. What are these WIMPs doing? So the standard idea is that WIMPs are forming a kind of gas. So you have an halo in our galaxy, for example, which is made of suspended WIMPs. And these WIMPs have, as we heard in previous talks, have an energy density of about 0.3 GeV over cubic centimeters. And they have an effective velocity in our labs, which is about 230 kilometers per second. This is because you imagine that these leftover particles from the early universe are kind of in a very cold state, so they are kind of steady, not moving, but we are moving, so our labs are moving, because the sun is moving around the center of the galaxy with a velocity which is compatible with this number, and of course the Earth is going around with the sun. So what happens is that in our labs we can have interactions between WIMPs and nucleons. And these interactions are elastic interactions, WIMP nucleon in WIMP nucleon, and the nucleon recoils in the crystal, in the gas, in the liquid, whatever detector you have in mind, with some energy.
Why do we always talk about nuclei and not about electrons?
Right. Indeed, we will talk also about electrons. The reason why we are talking about nuclei now is the following. Nuclei that are typically used in these experiments are nuclei with a mass close to the mass of the WIMP. And the reason for that is that the collisions that you have in mind are classical collisions, are not non-relativistic collisions. This velocity here is 10 to the minus 3 the velocity of light. So it's a ballistic collision, essentially. In the ballistic collision, the maximum energy transfer occurs when the mass of the two particles are more or less the same. And the reason why you want to go towards the maximum energy transfer is that you want to do in such a way, you hope that you transfer all the energy of the kinetic energy of the WIMP to the nucleus in such a way that you can overcome the threshold that you usually have in detectors. Detectors are sensitive to soft recoils, but not so soft. So you need to go in the maximum energy transfer region. Of course, if you had a WIMP with a mass not of 10 GeV, but as we will see in the strongly interactive massive particle scenario, a mass of 1 eV, so you should forget about nuclei and you should talk about electrons. And this is indeed what people do. So this plot is one of the few plots we didn't see already today. This is the plot that shows you how seriously people have taken the WIMP idea over the years. There are many, many experiments which have been looking for WIMPs. And as we heard in the previous talk, one of the last is Xenon 100. What is this talk telling you? So all these curves are projection or real experiments. Whatever you have in this plane, which is above this curve, is excluded by the experiment that you can read here. For example, Xenon is excluding all this region of WIMP masses and cross-section. And the reason is that you didn't see any interesting nuclear recoils in this region. So the mass of the WIMP is basically telling you how much the nucleus is recoiling. If you have a larger mass, since the velocity is always around 230 kilometers per second, the kinetic energy is the mass of the WIMP times 10 to the minus 3 to the second power. That is the kinetic energy. So the maximum transfers that you can have is about 1 keV. So if you enlarge the mass of the WIMP, you will have harder kinetic recoils. And if you go to softer region, you will have softer kinetic recoils. So the reason why all these curves are doing like that is that all these experiments die. I mean, they are not able to see softer recoils. And so if you go in this region where the mass of the WIMP is 1 GeV or even less than that, you don't have good ongoing experiments able to say something. So this arrow means imagine to go much lower than this for the mass of the WIMP. And we will talk about that. So as I said, the kinematic is basically classical.
Why do we expect WIMPs to have typical velocities, which are galactic velocities, essentially?
Because you expect that dark matter now in the present universe is extremely cold. And so the important part of that motion is your motion, is your lab motion. But of course, that is not the end of the story because you have an escape velocity in the galaxy. And the escape velocity is more or less the square root of 2 times the potential. And so you know that the escape velocity is about 550. So you have actually a range of possible energies, and you can just weight this range of possible velocity with a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, not really having in mind that you have an equilibrium temperature, but you have a kind of equilibrium velocity. The reason you don't think to an equilibrium temperature is that weakly interacting massive particles are supposed to have very weak interactions among themselves too. So they are not very much prone to equilibrate in the temperature. This is the question that we had before. This is Dama, which is the elephant in the room of this physics here. So Dama is the only experiment having a signal. And Dama has crystals made of sodium and iodine. And so you have two regions, basically, here. And if the recoils are recoils of sodium, that means that you are looking at a light dark matter. And if the recoils are in the region of iodine, you are looking at a heavier dark matter because of what I said. When the mass of the dark matter is the same as the mass of the nucleus, you have an optimum energy transfer. Very quickly, Dama so Dama exploits the fact that the Earth goes around the Sun with some angle, and the Sun goes towards the Cygnus with this characteristic velocity. But when the Earth is moving along this path over here, the velocity, the effective velocity that you have of your WIMPs in the lab is a little bit less than when the Earth is going along this direction. So there is a seasonal effect. When you go like here, you expect harder recoils of the nuclei here. And here you expect softer recoils of the nuclei. And so the expectation of Dhamma was to observe softer and harder recoils depending on the season. And they do that. They have data here which show that the recoil rate as a function of the kinetic energy of the recoiling nucleus is a term which changes with the frequency of rotation of the Earth around the Sun. And these points are witnessing that. It's a very interesting fact. It's also very interesting that no one is able to reproduce Dhamma. We can talk about that if someone is interested. Now, the point is directionality. As was mentioned in the previous talk, if we go back to this picture, you see that there is another ingredient here, which is neutrino scattering. Now, neutrinos have neutral current interactions with quarks. Of course, if they have neutral current interaction with quarks, they can have neutral current interaction with nuclei as well, and this is what is meant by coherent scattering. And the scattering of a neutrino on a nucleus is basically what everyone has in mind when one thinks to the scattering of a WIMP with a nucleus. The thing that everyone knows is the scattering of neutrino with nuclei. The point is that neutrinos from the Sun and atmospheric neutrinos will do the same recoils that the WIMP would do. And so when one talks about a neutrino wall, it means that you cannot go in this region because this region is mimicked by scattering of neutrinos. So you cannot learn very much if you go here. But as it was observed in the previous talk, if you had a perfect control of directionality, you would know that neutrino scattering, for example, from solar neutrino come from that direction, and scatterings from the Cygnus come from another direction. And so you could discriminate between these two. Now, nanotubes were proposed as a possible directional detector for the reason that I'm just telling you. Imagine to have a nanotube. What is a nanotube? It's a graphene sheet which is rolled up on a cylinder. And so you have a cylindrical graphene foil. You can have a WIMP nanotube interaction here. And this interaction can just make a nucleus of carbon to recoil in the body of the nanotube. So you pay a price for ejecting a carbon nucleus inside the nanotube, and this price in terms of energy is a few electron volts, 20 electron volts to liberate a carbon atom inside the nanotube. If you pay a little bit more in terms of energy, you can ionize this carbon atom, and so you can have a carbon ion in the nanotube. Now, the point is that from some theoretical observation about the nature of graphene, it is known that a positive ion, when a positive ion approaches the surface of this nanotube, it can feel a repulsive potential due to the texture of atoms on the graphene foil. So what happens is that the positive ion could just be reflected from the surface, provided that this transverse motion is soft enough in such a way that you get reflected by the potential barrier which the wall is basically producing. So if the initial conditions are such that you have the right direction, so if you have an ion which is the more collinear to the axis of the tube as possible, then you will have a transverse velocity which is very small, and you have a chance to be reflected from the walls of the nanotube. This is a picture of a forest of nanotube that we made in Rome. These are long 200 microns, and the typical radius is about 10 nanometers. And they look straight, to tell the truth. It's a very large forest of them. Now, depending on the chemical processes which bring to the synthesis of these carbon nanotubes, they can behave as metallic, they can have semiconductor behavior, and they can have also mixed behavior. There is very complicated the way in which they their conducting properties. And but in all cases, as you can see, for example, in these physics reports over here, it is expected that a positive ion will read a potential barrier close to the surface of the nanotube. So in this respect, the nanotube is basically an empty channel because there is nothing in it. All the electrons are just on the surface. So you have an empty channel which could have a reflecting power for a positive ion. And so it could channel the positive ion inside. So if you orient this channel in the direction of the sinus, and so you and then you have a forward scattering which is injecting the positive ion in the direction of the tube, you can expect a good channeling of this ion. And at the end, you could make an apparatus like this. You can put a substrate here, some carbon nanotubes on one side and carbon nanotubes on the other side. These are the WIMPs which come from the Cygnus. Now, these WIMPs have to be have to have a mass which is close to the mass of the carbon, so you should be in the range of 10 GeV, and they can recoil a carbon ion in the tube that gets channeled, and at the end it exits from the tube, and it can go out from the tube only if it's channeled for a while, if the initial conditions are the good ones. Then you end up in a gas chamber, you have an electric field, for example, and you can drive this carbon ion to a detection region, which can be pixels or gems or whatever. So we tried some solution also. On the other side, instead, if you eject a carbon ion here or here, then it will just travel towards the substrate. So you will die in the forest. So you will have carbon ions exiting on one side and dying on the other side. You can rotate the apparatus. And you can see what happens rotating the apparatus with respect to the direction of the Cygnus. And so the fact that you have this freedom to rotate the apparatus with respect to the direction is giving you a handle on the background, because you know where the WIMPs should come from.
Wouldn't you have the same handle without the substrate?
Well,
the ions are going out one.
Absolutely. You can do without the substrate. It's just to have two target masses on two angles.
What is the origin of the repulsive potential?
The origin of the repulsive potential, unfortunately, I don't have the formula here. The origin of the this repulsive potential has been computed in a number of papers and then summarized here. The origin is the crystal structure of the carbons on graphene. And so you can effectively compute that, and that is providing. So it's just solid state, that's the origin. It's just this is something which I don't control to the end, but what these people say is that if you write down the equations for the potentials that you expect in the vicinity of the tube, you should get eventually something like that. It depends also on the structure of matter, and you can see it from here that it depends. Ah, no, that is not. So this is a positive ion, which is very close. No, it's of course not the carbon. So the positive ion, the positive carbon, approaches the surface and gets repelled. And the larger is the charge of the positive ion, the larger is that charge, and the most effective is the barrier, not the. And it depends also on chemical characteristic of the nanotube. So if you change, for example, to try to reply to your question, imagine that this is the hexagonal structure of graphene, and then you have these two directions, the non-orthogonal direction of the lattice, and then you decide that you are rolling up the nanotube along this direction, which is one particular direction with a fixed n and a fixed m, which are two integers. Then depending on n and m, the kind of potential that an ion could feel changes. For example, if you have n and m, like this is It's a plot that I did. If you have N and M like this, you will have a flat potential like a wall. But if you use N and M, which are equal, you will have windows, basically. So there is a plethora of potentials that a positive ion could feel when it is close enough to the surface of the tube. So it depends on the structure of matter in the sense that it depends on the synthesis of the nanotube as well.
But it depends on, I mean, because the atom is not bigger than the lattice spacing, no? So doesn't it depend whether you approach the center of all the hexagons or the vertex?
Well, this is it cannot depend by that. It's a kind of effective potential that you feel when you approach the wall. It's not because you see, if you look at the numbers over here, the barriers are very small. So it's 300 electron volts, things like that. So if you are harder than that, that means that your wavelength is probing a smaller region of the structure, then you go through. So you have to have a very low energy. So your wavelength should see a piece of material. So you should be below 300 electron volts, basically. This is the number that they have. Now, I agree with you that I would be very much happy to see this channeling experimentally instead of trusting this kind of things. And this is exactly what we try to do.
Just to make sure I understand, if you can go back one slide.
Which one?
Wait, this one, yeah.
This.
So basically, just to make sure I understand. So you have an event where a dark matter particle scatters an ion, and eventually you see something only if the ion travels through the channel.
Yes, because it must be channeled. If the direction is, if the initial direction is wrong, it dies inside the forest.
So this means that
it gets stuck in the forest.
Yeah, so in a sense, it's inefficient if you think of, in the sense that many events that you could have in there, you're not going to see.
Absolutely. The inefficiency is there for sure, but imagine that the typical experiments that would like to exploit channeling for doing directionality were taught in crystals. Now, crystals channel have a much smaller radius with respect to the 10 nanometers, and the electrons will kind of be inside the channel. So you would have a lot of energy losses in going through the channel. At least this is an empty channel. And so you have the least interactions possible inside the nanotube, at least that.
Okay.
But as I will show you, we learned that you can use the interstices between the nanotubes eventually instead of the bulk. And that is probably more efficient than the bulk itself. So to make it short, we made a number of simulations to see Monte Carlo simulations to try to understand this kind of detectors. And we had reasonable results about that. If you want, we can comment them. And also we could draw an exclusion plot on the top of the other, which is a projection, of course. And so if everything were perfectly ideal, if you had single wall nanotubes with perfectly working potentials, et cetera, you could have an interesting exclusion region here, which starts to be in the place where other experiments cannot go. Now, to address your question, we also thought that if you look at a forest of nanotubes from the top, it looks like a billiard. Now, forget about the interior of the nanotube. Imagine that the WIMP is scattered here, and then it approaches another nanotube here, and there is a reflection of that because the transverse momentum is very small. So there is a reflection here, and it keeps going like that. So this, in mathematical physics, is known as the Sinai billiard. It's a kind of standard problem in probability. So you can make a simulation of this object. You can use exact results, for example, the time it takes for the WIMP, in this case, to exit from this region. And what we learned with these simulations is that, indeed, the forest of nanotubes could cooperate as a kind of ensemble of channels to make this directional effect. The lateral losses are negligible, and interestingly enough, the interstices are probably better than the nanotubes themselves. They can behave as nanotubes. I mean that this region is a kind of a nanotube that you can engineer. You can just
make this distance different than what it is, and you can have different sizes here. You can also randomize the position of the nanotubes. You can do many things.
But how do you have then information
if you have? No, the problem is no. This is the scattering in the plane. So this is a section of the nanotube forest. So now you inject an ion in this plane, and it keeps on scattering like that, right? But it also has a velocity in the other direction. This velocity is the small velocity. It's the velocity which allows you to be reflected from the barrier. And then there is the driving velocity, which is in this direction. So it keeps scattering this way, but in the meanwhile, it goes there. And at the end, you have a detection apparatus at the end of this 200 microns or 100 microns, whatever. So basically, there are two motions. One motion in this way, which is the one due to the scattering with dark matter, is the forward scattering with maximum energy transfer. And then there is another motion, which is transversal motion, which has to have an energy below, say, 200, 300 electron volts, to make this channeling possible. So the directionality is in this direction, not in that.
So you're still imagining a motion that is mostly parallel to the tubes?
The WIMP comes from the blackboard. It makes a recoil in this direction. And the recoil in this direction has a transverse velocity. The transverse velocity is soft. And the recoil in this direction is soft. So it's basically like orthogonal to the blackboard. And so why is this, it is proceeding in this direction every one hour, and then it scatters from the tube and gets expelled from the forest. So there are two motions. It's a composition of two motions.
But then the dark matter needs to interact pretty frequently then.
The dark matter interacts only once, because the interaction of dark matter is almost zero. So the interaction produces an ion,
okay.
And it's that ion which goes around and then eventually is detected.
Okay.
In all this apparatus, like that, the interaction is just one.
Okay, 100%.
Yeah. Now, then we decided to make some trials. So with a ridiculous budget, we went to the Frascati BTF facility in Italy. And we brought there an array of nanotubes, and we used a beam of electrons of about 500 MeVs. And this beam of electrons is just pointing towards the nanotubes, like tangentially, like that. So they should be able to scatter an ion out in the bulk of the nanotubes or in the interstices. And then, if you change the direction, the relative direction, with respect to the electron beam, you should be able to see a channeling or no channeling, depending on the fact that the ion gets trapped in the forest or not. So this is what we did. This is a forest of nanotubes. You cannot see them, just a kind of black hairs on a surface. And then you put it in a field cage, and the electron beam should come in this direction, for example, and then you have different directions of the electron beam. You can move the cage on the electron beam. And you put a detection apparatus on the basis of this tower here. And this is the beam coming from the accelerator. It goes inside this vessel where the nanotubes are. And so you can move the vessel, so you can decide that the electrons go on the nanotubes or off them, so you can move them. And this is the funny results that we get. So 1 centimeter, the electrons, imagine that, go this direction. They don't meet the nanotube at all. So what happens? That the electrons go here, in this direction. They go through a gas. There is a ionization. There is an electric field in this cage, which is pointing upwards. So the electrons go through. They ionize the gas. And there are charged particles which fall to the bottom. And on the bottom, you switch on some pixels. So the electron goes at 1 centimeter, you see this trajectory, 2 centimeters, this trajectory, 3 centimeters, another trajectory. When they approach the nanotube, we found a breaking of the trajectory, like this. So the breaking of the trajectory, our interpretation of this breaking was that carbon nanotubes are indeed the one that you can commercially buy for humani are indeed fantastic metals. They all act as perfect metallic spikes. So what happens, that this was our interpretation, is that the electric field that you put from the outside, the external electric field that you put in the cage, when it's close to the nanotube, goes on the nanotube, it's a kind of spike effect. And so what happens is that these electric field lines terminate on the nanotubes. And so what happens is that the trajectory of an external electron gets bended following the electric fields on the nanotubes. And this was a kind of shock for us because we didn't have in our group any solid, really competent solid state physicists who could tell us, look, they are fantastic metals. We had to learn that like this. Let me interrupt this for a while and talk a second of SIMP paradigm. SIMP means strongly interactive massive particle, and this is more or less goes in the direction of your previous question. So this was proposed by these people over here, and then from Murayama and same people. And their idea is to shift completely the problem of thermalization. So they don't want to have dark matter, anti-dark matter annihilations into standard model as the mechanism which depletes the initial number of dark matter particles and bring that to the present. They want to have a mechanism inside the dark sector. So you have WIMPs of some kind. We will see which kind in their mind. And this, these particles, let me call them SIMPs as they do, this particle can do 3-to-2 processes. And in these 3-to-2 processes, you reduce the number of particles not inside the dark sector. So you don't communicate with the standard sector here. You just reduce them in this way. Now, of course, the first thing that you can say about this kind of processes is that they are pumping energy in the dark sector. Because you have 3 particles in the initial state and 2 particles in the final state. That means that the mass of this particle has to be converted into kinetic energy in the final state. So you are eating the dark sector. So they are perfectly aware of this, and so they are adding an interaction of the WIMPs with the standard sector in such a way that you can kind of dump all this heat, which is coming from this 3-to-2 process on the standard sector. So they couple the SIMPs with standard particles through dark photons, basically. The interesting point about this scenario over here is that this scenario it exists also in the standard model, for example. You have 3-to-2 processes in which you can flip the parity, for example. And these are the ones that are expected from the Vest-Zumino term in the Lagrangian of pions. So you have 5 Goldstone fields here with a epsilon, which makes the flip of the parity. And this is a process in the standard model, which could simply be there as a non-resonating process, thanks to the Vest-Zumino-Witten term. So basically, they have in mind a sector of dark particles, of dark matter, which is made of some kind of pions. And they studied this sector of pions, and requiring to have a solid chiral perturbation theory in this dark sector, and requiring to fulfill the constraint on dark matter self-interactions, which could be strong in their approach, they find that the typical mass of their dark pions should be in this range. So the first thing that comes to your eye is that you are decreasing immensely the mass of the dark matter particles from the GV to the MEV region. And so this kind of exercise is, of course, strongly motivated from that plot that I showed to you before. You didn't find anything in the 10 GV to 1 TeV region, let's try to motivate the search in the light sector.
So you're getting very close to the real pions.
You're getting very close to the real pions because they are doing basically real pions, more or less. And also, as it occurs for real pions, there are a lot of things that can jeopardize this approach. For example, real pions decay. A real pion can decay if you couple these dark pions to the standard sector with some dark photon. These pions can decay into dark photon, and then with an epsilon coupling to standard particles. So this anomalous decay could be another way of depleting the dark matter abundance, which is not the 3-2-2 process which I said to you before. Of course, you know that in the standard model, this is the anomaly, and this anomaly diagram has, in the standard model, is T3 times Q squared. Now, you know that in the standard model, this is different from zero because the mass of the up, the charge of the up is different from the charge of the down quark. But they can, in the dark sector, they can work on that, and they can have quarks which make this anomaly equal to zero, so they have a receipt for that. But this is not even enough, because also in the standard model, the pion can decay into two photons, not through the anomaly. It's much less efficient, but it can decay like this. Pion can decay into two photons through three gluons, and this is a photon. In this case, I wrote a paraphoton, but okay, it could happen like that too. And so, now let's suppose that all these things are solved. What is the bottom line? The bottom line is that you have a sector of light pions, which are your dark matter. And as we commented before, you should not take care of nuclear recoils any longer. Forget about the nuclei and go to electron recoils. So the same group, which is...
Would you have dark baryons and dark blue balls also?
You could have all of those pieces. But the problem is that you want to have the lightest dark hadron as possible in such a way to stabilize it and to make it to the press. For example, you could have the rho. You could have a vector sector, and the rho could decay into pions, and then you have to find a way to stabilize the rho if you want it to be the dark. But the dark is the lightest one. So that's the idea. But remember that the pi zero decays. So it's something that you have to handle. So. Now, this group, which is Hochberg, Talli, Lisanti, Zurek, Kahn, etc., proposed to use, again, two-dimensional materials, in this case graphene, as a target for recoils of electrons, in this case, instead of nuclei. So basically, this is the band structure of the graphene. And you see that there are pi electrons, which are less bound, and an sp2 electrons, which are more bound. And what they find in the calculation they propose is quite interesting. They observe that if you have, they more or less follow the scheme of the nanotubes I described before. So if you have a spray of WIMPs coming from the Cygnus, and you put a graphene sheet in between, orthogonal to the main direction, which is the direction of the Cygnus, then you should observe efficient electron recoils. Now the mass is tuned on the mass of the electron. What they find is that the maximum probability is reached when theta goes to zero. So the cross section is larger for orthogonal recoils, and much smaller if you rotate this graphene sheet with respect to the Cygnus, the probability of ejection goes down. This is what they found. And so in this plot, you will have a WIMP-like, this is the cos of theta, and this is the number of recoils, basically. You will have a WIMP-like behavior. So when theta is close to zero, this is the 10 GeV, and this is the SIMP-like, so 10 MeV, so much, much, much smaller. So you will have a very strong effect. So a very strong effect of directionality of this apparatus. And of course, they want to be able to measure the angle with which this electron is ejected from the graphene plate. Now, the interesting part of this proposal is that there is an experiment proposed by Chris Talli at Princeton, which is called Ptolemy. And this is a very solid proposal which exploits graphene planes to a search for relic neutrinos. This was the original idea. Now, this proposal here comes on the top of Ptolemy, so use the same apparatus for dark matter instead of relic neutrinos. And the Ptolemy scheme in the dark matter version is seriously analyzed today to enter into the Gran Sasso labs. So, and it has been discussed to use graphene or nanotubes and things like that. Indeed, we tried also electrons from carbon nanotubes. So after them, we tried to see what happens if you have electron recoils due to light, strongly interactive massive particle. But this time, after the lecture that we got from that original experiment, we considered that you would have spike effect of the electric field in the vicinity of the nanotube. So the apparatus in this case would be extremely simple. You have a substrate here, many nanotubes. Then you eject an electron instead of an ion. And this electron has a few electron volts in energy. And this electron is pointing towards the place where the electric field is. This time, there is no repulsion because it doesn't work. And so the electron could just be sucked by this super strong electric field. So even if you have 10 kilovolts per centimeter between the cathode and the anode, in the proximity of these fantastic metals, you can have extremely strong, like 500 kilovolts per centimeter for free. And so you can suck electron out, and then you don't even need to measure the angle of ejection of the electron. You just have to count one electron. You see one electron, then it could be that electron. You rotate the apparatus with respect to the signals, and so on and so forth. How much time do I have left? So
5 to 10 minutes.
So if it's 5 to 10 minutes, let me just skip to the last part. This is just to tell something also on this, axion-like particles with sub-Terra Hertz light. This is another proposal we did, which is extremely modest with respect to the Casper that we heard before. This is was a tentative to do something quick for axion-like particles. And so let me illustrate what a light shining through hole experiment is quickly, and what is this proposal. So in general, the light shining through hole experiment is a kind of directional experiment, as before. You have a source of light here, and you inject laser light into a magnetic field, which is orthogonal to the laser light. And you have a Fabry-Perot cavity, and in such a way, you have a laser light traveling between two mirrors inside this magnetic field for as long as possible. Then, as we heard before, you have a finite probability of converting one of these photons into an axion. And of course, the better the quality factor of this Fabry-Perot cavity, that means the most back and forth travels you do, the better is the probability of having one of these axion out. Now, the axion can go in this direction, finished, or in this direction. If it goes in this direction and it's collinear to the electron beam, it's found to be collinear to the electron beam, it can go through a wall. You can put a wall, a physical wall. And after the wall, you can set another magnetic field of the same entity of this. You use uniform magnetic field and constant in time magnetic field. It's crucial to have the two things. And in this point somewhere, you have a finite probability of converting back the axion into a photon. If you have a detector here, you should see a flash of light, which has exactly the same frequency of the light which comes out from the source. It is exactly in the same direction of this laser light, but you should see it in the black room. So you should see a flash in there. This kind of experiment is already running at DESI, so there is a light shining through wall at DESI working. This kind of experiment is the same scheme of the CAST experiment, which was named before. And our simple idea to try to do something alternative to what is done now is to use a different source of light. Instead of using laser light, using microwave light for this reason. So the number of events, the rate of events, goes like the rate of photons you produce in the source times the probability of converting a photon into axion and back. Now, this product over here pays a very strong penalty. Now, from present limits, it's known that G times magnetic field times this L, which is the extension of the magnetic field, is a very small number. So this is 10 to the minus 35, say. And so you have very few events, even if you have a good magnetic field and like 15 Tesla.
G
is the coupling of the axion to photon-photon. It's the same coupling which was discussed before. So this number is super small. This is the number that you get from a laser, so the number of photons per unit of time. And if you change your source and you go to the microwave, for example, you use gyrotrons, which are commercial sources of microwaves. You can just buy them already working. Then you could increase by 10 orders of magnitude the number of the yield of photons. And so you can have more events per year. So the number of light shining through all events per year gets super increased. And if you have a good quality factor in the microwave range, then you can go even better than that. Now, with respect to the Casper, which we heard before, this is more modest. This is a typical gyrotron that you can buy in a shop. It's more modest in the sense that it's exploring a region which is similar to the region of Alps and CAST. And so it's the region of axion-like particles. It's very hard to go to the QCD axion with this kind of experiments. None of them can do that. But suppose that the axion is not the QCD axion, which is that particle that realizes a matching between the mass and the coupling constant, which is fixed by QCD. Suppose that there is another scalar or pseudoscalar particle which does not have those conditions, so axion-like. Well, this kind of experiments could be done quickly, and you could explore a region which is deeper in this block. Now, what we found is that everything looks straightforward, but the problem is, do you have a detector that you can buy in the shop for photons in the 30 gigahertz range? And this was kind of discovery. Like, a photon in the 30 gigahertz range is a 1 centimeter photon in wavelength. So to read that, you should have an antenna, which is a macroscopic size antenna. And this antenna should be matched. So you should have a very good impedance matching of this antenna with some sort of detector. And so a group in Scuola Normale Superiore in Pisa of collaborators of us started working on the possibility of exploiting TES detectors for single photon detection in the 30 gigahertz range. Now you have an antenna here, which is this spiral antenna, and then the TES is here. What is the TES? It's an interesting object. It's a transition head sensor. It's a superconducting material, which lives exactly at the temperature of phase transition between normal metal and a superconductor. So as soon as a photon goes through the TES, by Joule effect, it eats the TES, and it brings the material out of the superconducting phase. And that produces a quenching in a circuit, in a biased circuit that you can put in that. And so the current immediately quenches in the system. And you can read this quenching with a squid. This is the essence of a TES. You have a variation of current, which is serious variation of current, and that produces a serious variation in the flux of magnetic field in this circuit. These are the first results obtained in Scuola Normale by Giazzotto et al., in which you can see this. So varying the temperature in a very, very small range, you have the resistance changes abruptly. So you can have very efficient tests. But of course, you have to work in the 10 millikelvin regime. So what appeared to be a super straightforward idea, you go there, you buy the gyrotron, and you make an experiment with few money that gives you an idea on the axion, like open another problem, like, can we do a detector in 30 gigahertz region? Then we learned that there are groups at Caltech trying to do these kind of detectors as well. But of course, with respect to what we heard before, so the fact that you can just tuning the magnetic field and go to the QCD axion and span all the region that we saw, this is at another level. So some concluding remarks. It seems that 2D targets could be a good way. This is not a technology that is already there. It's not like atomic clocks in the first dog. This is a technology which is done, right? So 2D targets could be a good way to go in the light direction. And all this research and development on the Ptolemy experiment in the version of dark matter search experiment is promising. They are seriously considered to go to the GS Grand Sasso labs. And we are discussing about the possibility of substituting the graphene sheet with nanotubes, at least for one reason. The graphene is flat, and it's difficult to keep it flat. And if you want to make a big target mass of graphene, you need a big room with these flat surfaces, one close to the other. On the other hand, if you have carbon nanotubes and you cut them short, and you put them in an HPD detector, in which you just count the single electron which comes out of that because of the same collision, you have a much more packed target mass in a smaller region. And so you can be more efficient with respect to what they have. And you don't even need to measure the direction of the recoiling electron. This is something which is discussed. Then there are millions of proposals for light dark matter. Basically, this group here tried all the possible materials like semiconductors, superconductors, superfluid targets. There is a lot of activity, it's interesting. And also recent paper on molecular vibrations go in that direction, but this is not directional detection, so it's a different story. So thank you for your patience. And
probably a stupid question, but you already pointed out that, you know, these carbon nanotubes are mostly empty space, right? Mm. How many of them do you need to have a cross-section?
Of course, you have to, this is the same problem of graphene, like, so you have, on a small substrate, you can pack up to a fraction of a gram. And so you have to imagine that single unit has to be put inside a detector of single electrons. And so you have a small cell, and then you have to scale this cell to reach the optimal thing. So we estimated like 10,000 of these cells. And then you have to put 10,000 of these cells on a system which is tracking the signals, basically. So you want a system which is rotating and following the signals in the sky during the day, in such a way that it's pointing in the direction of the wind all the time. And for the graphene, it's the same. Of course, they don't want to rotate, they have other ideas. But you need the target mass you need. But directionality helps you a lot in reducing the target mass with respect to crystal experiments or gas or liquid experiments.
This morning we were told that for very light dark matter like this, we shouldn't think of it as particles, but rather as some field. Does that picture affect the?
Well, we are talking about this talk. I talked about MeV dark matter, MeV, millions electron volts dark matter. So these dark pions should be in the MeV range. And so, like, two times the mass of the electron, something. The observation this morning, where when you consider moduli, dark matter, etc., so you are in powers like 10 to the minus x electron volts. And in that case, you have to go to collective phenomena. And so you have to write a classical fields with a frequency, etc. But when you are in the MeV range, you can treat that as part.
So in the last part of your talk, this light shining through walls.
Yes.
You're not really detecting dark matter there, but you're just sort of producing dark matter.
I can tell you, for example, of this experiment at CERN, which is a light shining through wall. It works like that. They took a quadrupole, a spare one, and they pointed this quadrupole to the sun. So imagine that inside the sun, you have a process of this kind, a photon, in the external field, which is a magnetic field, producing an axion. And this axion is reaching your magnetic field at CERN. In that magnetic field, you convert back the axion into an X-ray, and you have an X-ray detector here, and that flashes. So if you are screening your magnetic field from all possible sources, and if you are patient to follow the sun during the day in such a way that you have a tracking system, and you see one of these flashes, of course. And CAST puts limits on that. So you are producing a photon out of the axion.
Yeah, no, what I'm saying is that you're not detecting the dark matter that is already there. You are producing
no.
an axion.
You are yes, of course. But then you measure the mass of that axion.
Yes.
And then if the mass of the mass of that axion is informing you about the abundance, I mean, you could have also a scenario in which dark matter is made of axion, of WIMPs, you have all of them. It's not told that it should be one kind of. And so you can say, I discovered the axion, the mass is this, and I can compute the Rayleigh
abundance.
But you are producing it. Yeah, absolutely. LHC,
yes.
The same.
Yes.
Absolutely the same. The same. Of course, LHC is, yeah.
Let's play Campanello again.